From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and it's Monday, although in China they are calling it Black Monday. The stock market there dropped 8.5% today, and that sent sell-off ripples around the world.
Right here in the U.S., the Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped 1,000 points right at the opening bell, but then gained back some of those losses almost immediately. That, by the way, Robin, was the biggest intraday drop for the Dow ever, 1,000 points.
It was quite something to watch.
Yeah, it was a little scary at the moment, but Diane Swonk joins us now. How to calm us down, perhaps. She's chief economist with Mesirow Financial in Chicago. And Diane, why shouldn't people be panicking today on a day when we see such a huge drop?
You know, the important thing to remember on days like this is, what do we know? We know that the market turbulence is driven by uncertainty, and some of that uncertainty was compounded by the Federal Reserve and their inability to commit or not commit to rate hikes in September. They can take that uncertainty off the table. We also know that we entered this period of turbulence with a tailwind of economic momentum that's very positive. Not only is employment picking up, but we also saw the housing market picking up. And at the end of the day, the wealth effects tied to housing and people's home values trumps that compared to stock prices.
But when you say that the Fed should take that uncertainty off the table, how do they do that? Does the Fed chair Janet Yellen come out today and say, everybody calm down, we're not going to raise rates next month?
Basically, you're going to see it if you don't see it from the Fed and some coordinated moves by central banks across the world. They're already, you can guarantee it, talking to each other. You will see by Saturday, Stan Fisher, who is vice chairman of the Fed, will come out and say, listen, we're more concerned about inflation than we were in just a few weeks ago. Lower oil prices, falling import prices from many of these emerging markets could lower inflation more. And that is reason for us to stay on the sidelines. Also, uncertainty about global economic growth. All those factors give them some decisive reasons to stay on the sidelines in September and not do their first rate hike in nearly a decade.
But isn't the main cause of this trouble in the market coming from China, worries about a slowdown in China?
There's no question that worries about a slowdown in China are the 800-pound gorilla in the jungle here. But, of course, that's not the only animal in the jungle. I think it's important to put China is very large. It's now the second largest economy in the world next to the United States. Yes, we are worried about a slowdown in China. Also, it's though a lack of clarity about Chinese policy. We do know that the Chinese government has an ability to stimulate, not the most effective stimulus, obviously, and they've compounded some of their problems. They're on a learning curve, a very long learning curve. I think we will see enough stimulus from them for them to creep along. I'm not sure we're going to see enough stimulus for their own population to keep those people in the middle class who have gained some momentum in recent years in China and come out of poverty very happy. And that's another issue for China is social unrest.
The political side of things, which we've talked about. But what about a deep slowdown in China? What kind of effect would that have on our economy in the United States?
Well, the most important issue is it doesn't take a hard landing, an actual contraction in growth in China for the Chinese economy to suffer pretty dramatically. You only need to slow down growth to the 5% range or so, maybe a little above that, where they may be close to now, to see a loss in growth in the middle class. And that's something that is the biggest problem, because what we were betting on is that China would be the next big consumers out there. And when their middle class is no longer growing, in fact, may be contracting, you no longer have that huge pent-up demand that many had hoped to tap. And that's why you're seeing many domestic stocks that have exposure to these emerging markets hit as much as 40% of the money of many of the S&P 500 stocks actually is earned abroad, not all of it in China. But China is, as I mentioned, the 800-pound gorilla in the room.
There are going to be some analysts who look at this and say this is a necessary correction. We have had such a huge run-up in stocks over the last many years since the financial crisis that, of course, they're going to come down at some point. They always do.
There certainly is gravity at play here, and I think that is true. I think also the reality that central banks can only do so much. The hope was that, you know, the policies that have been enacted would stimulate growth enough so that markets would eventually catch up with the underlying fundamentals. The reality is that profits have been okay, but not spectacular. They were great coming out of the crisis. We saw a lot of restructuring, but of balance sheets, we have a lot less debt. We have a lot more cash on corporate balance sheets than we once did. That's also a buffer against a slowdown in the global economy and a buffer against the stock market volatility. That said, did what we see actually, was it justified? And I think we did get a little bit ahead of ourselves, and now we've got to allow the economy to catch up. The willingness of the Federal Reserve to stand on the sidelines and allow the economy economy to catch up a little more and get that temperature of the economy a little hotter, I think is what this market will need.
What should the average person do, though, as they watch the market drop like this day after day?
Well, you know, unfortunately, I know how hard it is. It's, you know, it, for me, I'm up all night watching the markets in China as well. It's like riding a roller coaster ride. I always go back to do what you know. What do you know? What does the money coming into your house look like? What does your home value look like? What does your current situation look like? And the bottom line is it's not perfect by any means from what it was before the crisis, but it's a lot better than it was just a few years ago. And we are seeing some tailwind of momentum. The extra bonus point is that we're going to see lower prices at the pump, which for the overwhelming majority of consumers is great news. I wish we felt it sooner here in Chicago. We got some refinery problems and we're not feeling it as much, but we will get to it in the next couple of weeks. And those lower prices at the pump are just a much needed, it's like a tax cut across the board for U.S. consumers.
Diane Swonk, chief economist with Mesirow Financial in Chicago on this very big day, bad day in the U.S. markets and markets around the world. Diane, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, President Obama returned to Washington today, a two-week vacation behind him, quite a month ahead. The New York Times compared September for lawmakers to April for accountants. And this September, the Pope will visit D.C., as will the President of China. And then there's that Iran deal with a mid-September deadline for a congressional vote. NPR White House correspondent Tamara Keith is here with a look ahead. Hi, Tam.
Hi there.
So the president is back. He's got a to-do list. Only 15 legislative days on the Senate calendar in September. What do you think is on that to-do list?
Well, there are a lot of things on that to-do list. I think one of the top priorities for the president will be this Iran deal, hoping to avoid a vote to get in the way of the Iran deal. That's something that that Republicans in Congress, they'd like to block it. But there are big things that are frequently on the calendar in September. Things like, oh, I don't know, getting a budget so we don't have a government shutdown. That's a big one. There's also a transportation funding bill that is going to need to be renewed. And they've been sort of, to use a term I hate to use, kicking the can on that for a couple of years almost now.
We have to come up with a new phrase for that because it is
It on layaway. They have been putting it on layaway for a while now. And it's unclear whether these sort of big things, the budget situation or the transportation funding bill, whether Congress will be in the mood to do a long-term deal or whether there will be more kicking of cans, laying
right
away.
Well, we'll go back to the Iran deal for a second because they can't kick that. There is a deadline. And as you said, Republicans are expected to make this effort to block it with a resolution rejecting the deal. The president can then veto that. Democrats are saying they have the votes to sustain his veto. In other words, they say Republicans won't be able to override the president's veto of their rejection of his deal. It's complicated. But are the Democrats right that they have the votes? Two Democrats now have said they oppose the Iran deal. There's the Senator Chuck Schumer of New York. And last week, let's listen, New Jersey's Robert Menendez.
My devotion to principle may once again lead me to an unpopular course. But if Iran is to acquire a nuclear bomb, it will not have my name on it. It is for these reasons that I will vote to disapprove the agreement and, if called upon, would vote to override a veto.
So he says there he will override a president's veto. Tamara Keith, how do the votes look right now?
Well, and Senator Menendez at the moment is under indictment. It is maybe not the most influential senator in the Democratic caucus right now. As far as probably the most influential senator in the Democratic caucus in the Senate right now, that would be Harry Reid, who announced yesterday that he is going to support the president and the Iran deal. Following that, Debbie Stabenow, who is a senator from Michigan, announced today that she is supporting it. The numbers, strictly speaking, in terms of who has said they support it, who has said they oppose it, all of the Republicans oppose it. Democrats are the real question mark, and the numbers are getting very close to a point where there would be no way to override the president's veto. And actually, some people are saying it's possible that a disapproval measure wouldn't even make it through the Senate because there'd be enough votes for a filibuster to prevent it from even passing and getting to the president's desk in the first place.
Huh. Well, we got about a minute left. We want you to comment on some 2016 presidential campaign news made over the weekend with reports that Vice President Joe Biden made a trip to meet with Senator Elizabeth Warren, which, of course, sent presidential politics watchers into a frenzy. former Trump advisor Roger Stone on CNN was talking about a Biden-Warren ticket. But your sense of how this is reverberating, is a Biden running by himself or with Elizabeth Warren, is that looking a little more real?
Just to throw a little cold water on the Biden-Warren ticket, Hillary Clinton also met privately and secretly until it was out with Elizabeth Warren back in February.
A Clinton-Warren ticket.
Everybody wants to meet with Elizabeth Warren because she's hugely influential, and a lot of people on the left wanted her to run for president, but she says she isn't going to. The draft Biden effort has brought on some more seasoned former Biden campaign operatives. So there are things happening. Joe Biden is making decisions. He had his weekly lunch with President Obama today, or he's having it. No word on whether they're discussing whether he might run for president or not.
A Biden-Obama ticket. Oh, wait, he can't do that.
Oh, wait.
NPR White House correspondent Tamara Keith, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
When you go to an art museum, are you giving your brain a workout? Art historian Jonathan Feinberg thinks so. He says that looking at pieces by artists like Jean Dubuffet or Joan Miró can develop your brain, and that perhaps art itself has helped humans become more creative. He writes about this in a new book called Modern Art at the Border of Mind and Brain, and he joins us now. Jonathan, welcome to Here and Now. And of course, full disclosure, we've known each other for a long time, and you've written about topics like this in past books, how the creativity of children's artwork has influenced some of the great artists of our time. But in this book, you ask why we make art, which is something we've done for thousands of years. What did you find?
Well, you know, I've loved images since I was a child, and I think I've made a whole career of trying to figure out why they have such a hold on me. And, you know, as you say, if you look at the cave paintings in the south of France at Chauvet, they're 30,000 years old, and that's 10 times longer than we've had written language. So if we're still doing it after 30,000 years, we probably need it for some reason, and I think we need it to complete the wiring of the brain.
To complete the wiring of the brain, that if we look at art, especially art that we don't understand, it may sort of rewire our brain and make us think of things in a different way.
Absolutely. I'll give you an evolutionary argument. It goes something like this. You know, if in nature you need to see what's in front of you or you're going to get eaten by a predator. And the truth is that probably less than 20% of what we see actually comes from the eye. Most of it comes from processing, intrinsic processing in the brain and the visual cortex, and it comes from memories and reason and emotion and all kinds of other things. So there's an inherently very creative act, and you're constantly revising what you think you see. And so if you don't have that creative capacity and you don't develop that creative capacity to be agile, you're at survival risk, I think. And I think that's something that art does for us that's very important.
It makes us more creative.
Yes.
Of course, there's no way at this point to scientifically test this argument and see if, in fact, we get more creative when we look at a piece of art that we don't understand.
Right. Science does not have the ability right now to look at the anatomy of a thought. But, you know, if you look at the most complex products of the brain, you can extrapolate the function of the brain. And in my view, somebody like Dubuffet, and I picked this particular work called Fluence, or fluidity as he in English, a painting that is so complicated there is no way to resolve it when you look at it. And it forces your brain to constantly try and fail. And the capacity to be able to try and put pieces together, to go to different parts of your brain, you know, when you look at – if you look at an fMRI of somebody looking at a work of art, you'll, of course, see the visual processing centers light up. But there's all kinds of other places in the brain that light up that people often thought of as just noise. But, of course, it's not noise. It's the brain searching all over the place to try and figure out, what have I seen before that looks like this? How could these pieces go together? What is it I'm seeing? It's an evolutionary thing that's happening there. And, you know, I think that we can look at a work of art and we can learn a tremendous amount about how the brain works, how things are sequenced and structured that we can't really see directly.
Is that true both for abstract art and art that is very representative of what it's supposed to be?
Well, of course, what we think of as representative art is on a flat surface, so it's pretty abstract too when you really think about it. We're just making more conventional assumptions about representational images.
You're taking a 3D object and turning it into a 2D object.
Yes. All of it is abstract. But it is as true certainly for things that we tend to think of and call abstract as it is for things that we call representation. And that was the first chapter of this book is dedicated to making that argument. You know, I've been lucky that I've known some of the great artists of my time, and I've known them well enough to see how they work. In that case, I took the example of Robert Motherwell, who was a good friend, and I knew him well enough that I could actually show in some of the recurring abstract forms what they represented in a very specific way, and that was an important discovery for me.
But you also quote Christo and Jean-Claude, famous artists who, among other things, did this incredible piece where they wrapped these islands in Miami in pink, what is it, canvas?
Well, no, it's a fabric they actually engineered so that it would float. It's a polypropylene.
Okay, so they did that. And you quote them here saying, "Our art has absolutely no purpose except to be a work of art. We do not give messages."
Right. Great art has a kind of disorganizing character to it. Christo and Jean-Claude, of course, are not neuroscientists. They don't talk in the way that I would talk about these kinds of things. But, you know, when you fall in love with somebody, you have to accept somebody else into your way of organizing your world. And it can be a little frightening at the same time as being exhilarating. And a great work of art functions that way. If you really have a deep encounter with a great work of art, it's disorganizing. And you have to allow yourself to experience that in order to really grow with the work. So for Christo and Jean-Claude, they don't have a political agenda in a very specific way. But what they do is they open up your consciousness so that everything around you looks like you never saw it before.
Hmm.
Great works of art really cause us to rethink who we are.
We're speaking with art historian Jonathan Feinberg, whose new book is called Modern Art at the Border of Mind and Brain. And all of the images that we're talking about, we'll post them at hereandnow.org so you can follow along. And Jonathan, what about somebody who's listening to this who says, you know, when I go into a museum, it doesn't speak to me. I look at the art and maybe if I see something I recognize, it makes sense. But if I see something I don't recognize, I don't understand how that's even art.
Well, the clue is probably to go in and just pick out one thing that you're attracted to and take the time to really look at it. Don't try and look at everything in the museum. Pick one or two things you really want to look at. And when you spend the time and really allow yourself to try and figure out, you know, what kinds of feelings it's bringing up in you, you have a better chance of really getting to the core of what it's about.
Well, one of the images that you bring up in this book is this. It's very funny. It's a dog. It's an Alexander Calder dog with a clothespin that is part of it. That's the head of the dog.
Right.
What does that do to you?
Well, let me tell you a funny story about that. You know, that particular image, Calder and Miro were very close friends for most of their creative lives, and they had no common language. You know, Calder's French wasn't very good, and, you know, he didn't speak Spanish. Miro didn't speak English. And they communicated with their materials over a period of about 40 years and were very close. And when Miro walked into, when Miro for the first time saw Calder's work, he saw works like that little dog with the clothespin, and he came home and said privately, you know, that's not art. And, but he liked it. He didn't know what to make of it. And when Calder went into Miro's studio for the first time, he saw that work that's also in the book called The Spanish Dancer, which consists of a plain blank board with a hat pin stuck through a feather and a cork. And he goes home and he says, I don't think that's art.
Huh.
Well, what's really interesting about that is they both pushed each other to the edge of what the definition of art was. And of course, the art is what we think it is. It's all, you know, it's the definition of everything that we consider to be art, and of course, that's always changing and expanding. And for them, they had a really powerful exchange over pushing each other through their materials and through their form to a place where they both got uncomfortable, and then they began to work with it.
So what does that dog mean to you?
Well, the dog is funny. on one hand. I mean, it's great to change a clothespin into a dog's head. It's just a funny transposition, right? And it's also very simple. You look at it, and it's just simple objects and a wire cutter and a pliers. He made that out of nothing. And so in one way, it seems so direct. But you begin to look at it carefully, and you begin to realize how complicated it is to have made that transposition of those elements into to see them in a different way. And that's what a lot of great artists are able to do, is they take you to something that you already know, and all of a sudden you see it in a way you never saw it before. You know, Picasso will do this with a fork. It suddenly becomes a bird's foot, you know. And you just you would never have seen it that way. But once you see it his way, you never again are able to erase that. Your vision has been expanded by his ability to show you another way to look at something.
You write, without letting go of control, we can't innovate. We must continually revise our patterns of thought to be creative or even to see what really exists in this world. And I wonder, as we talk all about innovation right now, and that if this is going to be the crux of the American economy and this is going to be what we need, what made you write this book and look into this question of what art does to our ability to think creatively and to innovate?
Well, I mean, that's what made me do it. It is, I think it's terribly important. We're having a big debate now about testing in schools. It's not about how much information you've gathered. We can go to the internet now and look up just about anything.
Yeah.
You need to be able to use your brain. You need to be able to think, and you need to put the pieces together in a different way. That creativity is what has made, given America its protean strength for the last century. And you look at, you know, what's going on in China, for example. You know, I get Chinese students who are very bright, really gifted people, but they've been trained in a system in which they learn to imitate, not to think. And the result is they really don't come up with the kind of creativity that my American students will come up with, even if the American students are in some ways technically less proficient.
Huh.
It's a very interesting thing to watch, and you realize how terribly important it is for all of us to be able to adapt and rethink and look at what's around us and put it together in different ways. That's what we have to do to survive.
That's art historian Jonathan Feinberg, whose new book is called Modern Art at the Border of Mind and Brain. Jonathan, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome. It's a pleasure.
I just spent a few days in Salt Lake City, Utah. At least I think I was there. I couldn't see the mountains. Salt Lake sits in a valley rimmed by the Wasatch and Ochre Mountains, as much a part of the skyline as skyscrapers are in New York. But the mountains were erased by smoke from fires in neighboring states. For instance, in the eastern part of Washington, air quality experts say it hasn't been this hazy or this unhealthy since Mount St. Helens erupted in 1980. Lisa Woodard is with the Spokane Regional Clean Air Agency in Washington. And Lisa, we're looking at fire maps online. You can track fires burning all over eastern Washington and northern Idaho. But what does it actually look like outside where you are?
Oh, there's kind of an eerie glow to the sun as it rose this morning. There's smoke hanging in the neighborhoods. It's very poor.
It's poor visibility, but what about the health?
Well, air quality right now is in the unhealthy range, and the unhealthy is about in the middle of the range. We've got very unhealthy and hazardous as two other categories that we've yet to hit today. We think we will stay in the unhealthy range, however.
Well, you did hit hazardous on Friday. What does that mean? I mean, what's the difference between unhealthy and hazardous? What are you supposed to do?
Well, when we're in unhealthy, it's especially important that people that have heart and lung diseases, elderly, children, avoid outdoor exertion, outdoor activity. When we get into that very unhealthy, most people, all people really should stay indoors.
Well, this is, it's summer. You know, it's an area where people are biking, hiking, even in Salt Lake, where officials there also release some, you know, health warnings. What happens if, you know, you do get sick? How do you know you're being affected by smoke?
Well, one thing we try to instill in folks prior to wildfire season is that if they are in a sensitive category, that they already have a plan in place with their doctors. Those who do suffer from heart and lung conditions, if they start feeling symptoms, it's very important that they contact their health provider as well.
Why do you think this is? Is this just because of all the fires that there's so much smoke?
Well, weather has a lot to do with what air quality is going to do on an hourly basis and on a day-to-day basis. And right now we're having a very strong inversion, and that inversion is trapping the smoke near the ground level. This inversion has been sticking with us. There hasn't been much of a breakup.
You know, we talked about the health aspects. I'm wondering, what does it do for people to be constantly reminded? I know in Salt Lake, seeing the mountains is a touchstone. When you can't see the mountains, it's sort of depressing. What's happening there in Spokane, just this constant reminder of the fires?
One of the things that I have heard over again is it really makes you appreciate the days that are clear and clean, and we often take those for granted until we don't have them. Most of our air quality days in this area are in the good category, and then we have some moderate days, but rarely are we in the unhealthy to very unhealthy range. So it is, I think, an eye-opener for a lot of people, and I think it definitely makes you appreciate the clear days that we have most of the time of year.
Yeah. Constant reminders. Do we understand even the moon rises orange?
Yes, I've noticed the last few days. Saturday we had a bit of a break, but Friday and Sunday evenings, the moon had a orangey, golden, yellow glow to it. Constant reminder.
Yeah. Lisa Woodard with the Spokane Regional Clean Air Agency talking about how the fires there are affecting air quality. Lisa, thank you.
Thank you.
10 years after Hurricane Katrina brought residents of the Gulf Coast to their knees, much of the physical damage in New Orleans has been repaired. Neighborhoods and communities rebuilt, schools, hospitals, restaurants reopened. But a deeper, invisible wound remains. Thousands of residents, and especially children, were traumatized by the storm and the displacement and struggle that followed. From WWNO in New Orleans, Lane Kaplan-Levinson brings us the story of how the storm unleashed a cascade of problems for one young man.
If only my bosses like my cooking as much as you two do.
In late August of 2005, Kendall Booker was in fifth grade watching cartoons. All of a sudden, the program blacked out and George Bush appeared on screen. Annoyed, Kendall flipped through the stations in search of another cartoon, but all he saw was the president.
My mind just snaps. Something really is going on, and it's serious to where this man is on like 50 channels. So I decided to listen, but at that time I couldn't comprehend everything.
Soon after that, Kendall's grandfather came in the room and told him they were leaving. He was living with his grandpa at the time, and his siblings were all split up, staying with different family members. Kendall and his grandpa went to a Days Inn in Dallas, but he had no idea where his brothers and sisters were. On the hotel TVs, things did not look good back home.
Everybody's saying this is a direct hit. Like, I don't know what that was, like, until I seen so many people crying on the TV and, like, this channel that they had for so many lost children. And I'm just wondering, where my brothers or anything, my sister?
Kendall was only 9 years old, and his grandpa wasn't explaining when they were going back home. Most importantly, he wasn't explaining when Kendall could go back to school. He loved being in school.
It was so fun to learn at that time. Like I used to just mug the clock, like, it's 3 o'clock, you serious? Every Tuesday before Katrina, we used to get out for 11 o'clock. I hated them days.
Kendall hated those days because it meant he had to go home. He grew up with an abusive single mom who beat Kendall and his siblings. It got so bad that school and neighbors noticed and called Child Protective Services.
They came on a fire escape and they came through our window. I just see them grabbing my brother, taking him out the window. It's some white people. It's like, what the hell is going on?
This happened when he was 5. His mom went to jail, and he and his siblings were split up into different foster homes where the abuse continued.
I was just in the room all day. As soon as I come home from school, I just in the room all day like an inmate. He probably gave me a snack every once in a while, and I broke it down because I felt like I wasn't eating as much, so I saved it.
Kendall went from one foster home to another for 5 years until he finally moved in with his grandparents. This was shortly before Hurricane Katrina. Through all of this adversity, Kendall says he never had any behavioral problems. But when he evacuated to Texas, his grandpa kept making promises that he couldn't keep.
What I really was missing was school. Like, he kept telling me, I'm going to sign you off for school. Man, He never put me in school. That's one thing I'm thinking about. Well, my family, that's another thing I'm thinking about. Like, all that's building up inside of me, so, like, that's how I flashed out the first time.
By flashing out, Kendall means his first violent episode. He describes it like a blackout. Alone in the hotel room, Kendall started throwing rocks he had brought from outside against the wall and through windows. He ripped the blankets, he broke the TV, but he has no memory of doing any of it.
It was just a bunch of things damaged in my hotel room. Everything was all over. I don't even know how they got me to the mental hospital. I can't even remember.
This marked the beginning of Kendall's flashouts that landed him in and out of mental institutions and jail for the next decade. It's like losing his only pillar of stability, the classroom, ended up unleashing years of pent-up trauma. Kendall experienced another trauma when he returned to New Orleans and saw an unrecognizable place.
It's like a tsunami came. Like, everything was everywhere. It looked like the whole world came down to New Orleans for Mardi Gras, and they didn't clean up afterwards. Like, it was obvious the city was dead.
This is what thousands of children returned to when they came home. Mental health professionals scrambled to help them cope with the shock.
Hi, my name is Beth Cooney. I'm the director of evidence-based practice for Project Fleur-de-Lis.
Fleur-de-Lis is an organization that was started in the wake of Hurricane Katrina to deal with long-term impacts of trauma that children experienced related to the storm.
We have kids that were floating on doors in the Ninth Ward here. We hear their stories, and they were 4 or 5, and they remember it. You know, they'll have tons of experiences, but they'll say that's the one that bothers them the most.
Cooney specializes in trauma-focused cognitive behavior therapy. The organization partners with schools, and together they identify students who may benefit from the program.
What we do is basically a trauma screening. So the way I kind of describe this to teachers, you know, sometimes you need to get your ears checked or your eyes checked. We're coming to kind of check how you're doing based on your experiences.
In addition to living through Katrina, many of these kids have experienced a high number of adverse childhood events, which many mental health providers refer to as ACEs.
Most of our kids have experienced, you know, 4 and 5 ACEs, having a mentally ill person live in your home, having experienced child abuse, physical abuse. We teach kids how to understand the things that they're experiencing because of trauma, things like nightmares, trouble sleeping, and we normalize that and say, you know, because you've experienced this traumatic event, this is normal.
Cooney says most of these kids also have post-traumatic stress disorder, and they're in a state of hypervigilance all the time. So they play games to learn how to relax and calm themselves down. Fleur-de-Lis' strategy to access these kids through schools is something the city at large is starting to embrace. One of the goals is to make the city's schools trauma-sensitive. Here's Charlotte Parent, Director of Health for the City of New Orleans.
Hopefully what happens is you begin to recognize when students are having issues, and instead of, you know, dealing with them in a way that is creating a bigger problem, and that this may be an acting out based on some sort of trauma versus the child is just a bad child.
This concept of asking what happened to you before judging behavior is just catching on with mental health providers around the country. And for a health department that usually focuses on issues like heart disease and diabetes, it means switching gears.
For us, what was identified by our community as the leading public health problem is violence. We can't address and arrest our way out of this and put people in jail. You have to reach down further and hopefully shift the paradigm from the parenting pieces all the way through.
Parent says it's impossible to ignore the impacts of Hurricane Katrina when looking at the city's current struggle with gun violence and high incarceration rates. The storm was 10 years ago, but it's a daily presence and always will be.
The effects of Katrina, you know, for a lot of us, whether it's children, adults, if you lived through it and you were here and experienced that, there's no way that that's going away. It is a death. So, you know, imagine if someone close to you passed away unexpectedly and you were left to try to figure out what to do.
She says Kendall Hooker's story is a familiar one. Kendall is 20 now and just graduated high school in May. He's living what he calls post to post, sleeping on different friends' couches each night, looking for work, and trying to stay out of trouble. But he still often feels alone.
Honestly, you just really got to train yourself, because a counselor not going to be there when you're at that point of, like, really, like, flashing out. And I know the choices I make have consequences.
He has a 5-year plan. By 2020, he wants to be financially stable, he wants a place to live, and he wants children. But most importantly, he wants to feel safe.
I just want being a better life to where I won't have to look back every time I step out, nothing like that. I want to really be comfortable with the life I live.
We're following a big sell-off in stock markets around the world today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell nearly 1,000 points at the open this morning, close to 7%. It did bounce back significantly. Stocks in Europe and Japan have also taken a hit, all after what some are calling Black Monday in China. The main index in Shanghai fell nearly 9%. That's the biggest single-day drop in more than 8 years. Derek Thompson is here to look at the implications. He's senior editor at The Atlantic. He joins us each Monday from New York. Derek, welcome back.
Hi, Jeremy.
And we first mentioned this term Black Monday being used to describe what happened in China today. But the original Black Monday in the stock market world was in 1987. What happened then?
In 1987, yes, and before that in 1929. You should have compared them. It's interesting how each of them sort of describe a different half of what's happening today. After the 1929 crash, Chase National Bank compared it to a, quote, orgy of speculation. And who was speculating? Everybody, in a way. But in particular, ordinary mom-and-pop stockholders who had debt and were getting into the market. That doesn't describe the U.S. right now. It really gets closer to describing China, because in the year before China's stock slide started, its Shanghai index was up 150% because tens of millions of ordinary mom-and-pop Chinese retail investors were getting into the market for the first time, and they now have been wiped out. But our stock crash, if it has any precedent, goes back to what you said, the Black Monday of October 1987, when the stock market fell 20%. That crash happened for a variety of reasons, some sort of wonky and programmatic based on the new computer software that traders were using. But if you look at some of the circumstances underlying that crash, you had the falling price of oil, number one, and you had a relatively healthy economy that was not going into a Great Depression. So I do think that in some very clear ways, today's crash is sort of like a mini version of the original Black Monday.
And the reason I say original Black Monday, and of course you're right, there was a huge crash everybody knows about back in 1929, although I believe it was a Black Thursday back then. So
Thursday, and there was also a crash, I believe, on Monday. And so they sort of retroactively applied the term.
OK, well, back in that big crash back in the 20s and the Great Depression. And then in 1933, we had President Roosevelt, FDR, trying to calm people down. Let's listen to him back in 1933. This is from a fireside chat.
Confidence and courage are the essentials of success in carrying out our plan. You people must have faith. You must not be stampeded by rumors or guesses. Let us unite in banishing fear.
And this is the kind of thing that we hear every time we see a big drop in the stock market, Derek. All of the analysts saying, don't panic, don't sell, just hold, and everything will be fine in the end.
Yeah, FDR, they're sounding a bit like the money manager in chief of the U.S. I do think that we could probably use his advice today. I mean, the weird thing is you have people on television saying, well, you know, the U.S. Could be at the precipice of a recession. But, you know, two really important points. First of all, this correction is coming after one of the longest bull markets without a correction in modern history. The Dow is up 200% from its 2008 lows. We have quite a bit of ways to correct all the way down to 2008. Second of all, and this is an obvious point, but bears repeating, the stock market is not the economy. And if you just look at the U.S. economy, there is a lot for consumers to like. You have steady job creation. You have rising, if slowly rising, wages, but hopefully some pressure on those wages because of really low unemployment. You have really cheap gas. You have low inflation. These are the markers of a healthy economy, albeit one that is threatened perhaps by China's slowdown.
Well, and could you say the same thing for China, that the stock market is not the economy? economy, because there are a lot of worrying signs in that economy right now.
There, I think that the correction is more of a reflection of underlying fundamentals. China says that its economy is growing at about 7% a year. It's probably growing a lot slower than that. You know that because the Chinese government is trying desperately to devalue its currency to juice exports. The irony of the government's corrections, its efforts to correct, is that China's crisis is an indictment of its government, which has spent lavishly to create domestic demand that hasn't really materialized. It has cities and housing and infrastructure that now resembles ghost towns. And you've had people for the last few years saying an overwhelming amount of commodity demand, of overall consumer demand, both for steel companies, construction companies, even tech companies like Apple, comes from this religious belief that China is going to keep growing at 9% every single year. And that simply can't happen when you look at some of the circumstances in the Chinese economy. So in many ways, this is the reckoning that has been predicted, I'd say, for at least 5 years.
You know, I'm glad you brought up Apple, because that is the one of the interesting stocks today. One of the interesting storylines coming out of this big drop. Of course, the Dow drops 1,000 points at the open. All kinds of stocks are falling. And then not long after that, Apple actually in positive territory for the day. So maybe some investors had some second thoughts.
Well, I certainly hope so. You know, I do think that you know, Apple is in many ways, in terms of its stock price, a kind of Chinese phone company. A lot of its future growth relies on Chinese people buying iPhones. So, you know, hopefully you still have some strong growth from there.
Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic. Derek, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.